Yesterday, I began
showing how Jesus opened his disciples' minds to understand two major Old Testament themes, which had not been taught by the rabbis in synagogue meetings. Two Old Testament themes the rabbis overlooked. And Jesus' disciples didn't know they were there either. And it was so important that his disciples understand those two major themes, because those two themes were to be the primary apostolic teaching agenda. And after he opened their minds to understand those two major themes, what did he say to them? Let me see if this is a quote or a misquote. "Please don't think I expect you to teach these two deep themes to the masses. It'll be over their heads. It's just for you as my apostolic elite." Does that sound like a quote or a misquote? Well, the way some Christians ignore what Jesus opened their minds to understand, it might as well have been just special in-depth teaching for them only, not for other Christians. But Jesus, after he opened their minds to understand what I call megatheme A and megatheme B, said to the disciples, "You are witnesses of these things." So was it for only for them? Or was it for them to proclaim? The fact that they had their minds open to understand those two major themes, which the Jewish rabbis did not see and were not able to teach, was going to make the Christian message very different from the regular teaching that Jewish rabbis gave in synagogues. This would be the major demarcation between Jewish understanding of Old Testament scripture and Christian understanding of it. So he opened their minds, and we began to trace through the scriptures some, not all, but some of the Old Testament passages that relate to what I call megatheme A, the suffering, dying, rising Messiah theme, ranging from Genesis 3:15 through to Isaiah 53. And then I said, Jesus did not just leave them with that, with their minds open to only one megatheme. He went on to open their minds to a second megatheme, connecting another set of dots, as it were, by going from one passage of the scriptures to another, using his macro teaching style, as opposed to the micro teaching style he'd used earlier, as I explained yesterday. And so we saw that he found the five passages in Genesis in which God promised under oath to bless all peoples on earth. And the fifth one was in Genesis 28 and verse 14. God said to Jacob, the grandson, "I will spread your disciples like the dust of the earth to the east and west," your descendants rather, "to the east and west and north and south of the world." For what purpose? Shopping, tourism, sightseeing. "All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring, not as you all cloister in one part of the earth." Yes, some of you will stay there to keep the home fires burning, fine. But I'm going to see to it that a large number of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are dispersed to the east, west, north, and south of the world, taking the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant, which was filled with promise of blessing for Gentiles, out there into the world. So there we have the New Testament's Great Commission in Old Testament prototype. And then Jesus could easily have showed how Joseph became the fulfillment of that glorious promise of a top and bottom line Messiah. You, or anyone wasn't here yesterday, please raise your hand. How many I want to see? A few. Well, I guess you'll just have to get the audio tapes, because I cannot review everything that I covered in this part of the message yesterday. But we worked our way through into the New Testament and saw that Jesus made Jerusalem the center of his operations for the 3 years of his public ministry, right or wrong. No, the Jews expected if he was a Messiah, that was where he would spend most of his time. Jerusalem, Judea. Where did he go instead? Up into northeastern Galilee, making little old Capernaum the center of his operations. Did that give him an audience of many Jews to minister to? Yeah, 500,000 or so living in Galilee. But what other audience did that give him access to and give them access to him? Syrians to the north. We will see today that he went up through the narrow part of Syria into Phoenicia for ministry. And on the other side of the Jordan River, the other side of the Sea of Galilee, was a nation where people spoke Greek, called Decapolis. Greeks had been there since the days of Alexander the Great. Because whenever Alexander the Great conquered another part of the world in his fast-spreading empire, it was his policy to send back home to Macedonia, his home turf, and call for a few thousand Greeks to be willing to uproot and be transplanted to form a Greek-speaking colony in the midst of the newly conquered non-Greek people. His intent was that the inferior conquered people would be so impressed with the beauty of Greek language, the tastiness of Greek cuisine, the stylishness of Greek dressing, clothing, that they would all decide to learn to speak Greek and eat what Greeks ate and dress like Greeks. Thus, his vast empire, he hoped, would become linguistically, culturally homogenized on the basis of Greek everything. Well, that was his goal. It didn't work. He died young. Four of his generals divided up his kingdom among themselves, fought among themselves, then the kingdom collapsed into chaos. Some of the Greeks he transplanted hither and yon said, enough of this nonsense, we're going back home. But those he transplanted to the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee said, hey, the winters are warmer down here. The soil is fertile. The trading is good with Syria to the north. So they stayed there. And in time, they increased in numbers and established 10 cities. Hence, the area was called Decapolis, 10 cities. And they were noted for trading with Syria to the north. And they had learned Aramaic for the purpose of trading with the Syrians. And they still spoke Greek as well. So, Jesus had access to 3 different categories of Gentile population, not too far away from that little part of the northeastern area of Galilee. It also meant he was close by Tiberias, where people spoke Latin, military personnel were coming and going from the rest and recreation center for Roman military personnel there. And so he was ministering in the Aramaic language. And we saw in Matthew chapter 4 that throngs of Syrians came down to be healed by him, and he healed them. Greek-speaking people came across from Decapolis, and he had an impact upon Latins too, as we saw through the healing of the centurion's servant yesterday. But then we began to say, do we not have 2 problem passages in Matthew chapter 10 and Matthew chapter 15. And those of you who were here yesterday heard me explain how liberals focus attention upon something that Jesus said to his disciples in Matthew chapter 10 and the other statement he made in chapter 15, which seemed to show him, indicating his purposes were only for the Jews, not for the Gentile world. And the reason the liberals endorse these 2 statements as something they believe Jesus truly would have said, a lot of other things that are in red letters in the New Testament, they question whether he ever said, because it doesn't sound rabbinic enough. It doesn't sound like something he would have learned from the rabbis, so they sort of limit Jesus to being influenced by the rabbis, do not credit him with the ability to think beyond the intellectual range of the rabbis. Of course, if you don't believe he's the Son of God and endowed with divine wisdom, I suppose you could start to think that way. So it's just a product of their unbelief. But they're overlooking evidences that their way of understanding those 2 problem passages in Matthew 10 and Matthew 15 is wrong. The evidence points to the opposite. I mentioned also that Muslim strategists in planning to facilitate the spread of Islam across the world at Christianity's expense, are drawing cues from liberal Christian theologians. Liberal Christian theologians are making it so easy for Muslim strategists to find way to be critical of the New Testament, critical of Christianity. They don't have to do the research. Liberal theologians just do it, and Muslims find it and say, we can use that. And my son, Shannon, living on an island called Batam, close to Singapore, was approached by a young Muslim woman. She wanted to convert him to Islam. He was too resistant, so she said, I want you to debate with the mullah. And so he accepted that, and the mullah began the debate by quoting Matthew chapter 10, verses 5 and 6, where Jesus said to his disciples, do not go among the Gentiles or enter any village of the Samaritans, go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. And the mullah, following the lead of Christian liberal theologians, said, that's an evidence Nabi Isa, the prophet Jesus, did not intend to launch a new world religion called Christianity on its way to the ends of the earth. He only wanted to call for reform within Judaism. Nabi Isa knew that Allah, God, was reserving the privilege of launching a world religion for Muhammad, who would come along 6 centuries later. And Nabi Isa did not want to preempt Muhammad's privilege. It was to be reserved for him. And then the mullah went on to quote Matthew chapter 15, verse 24, where Jesus, in the context of a Gentile woman pleading for him to heal her demon-possessed daughter, declared, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Not first, but only. Well, we call that seemingly anti-pentalogic statements from the lips of our Lord. And I left you hanging yesterday. Well, that young Muslim woman named Yessie thought, oh, the mullah's won the debate already. Here he is quoting from the Christian scriptures to show that Christianity wasn't even supposed to exist. It got to exist because of his disciples' disobedience to those two commands in Matthew 10 and Matthew 15, just because when they tried doing what he had commanded, preaching only to Jews, the Jews were not very responsive. Whenever there happened to be a few Gentiles or Samaritans in the mix, they were just more responsive. And just because it was gratifying to get the response, with the passage of time, what did the disciples find themselves doing more and more? Preaching to responsive Gentiles and Jews, and not preaching very much to hard-headed, stubborn Jews. Thus, Christianity was launched on its way toward the ends of the earth, not by their obedience to Jesus' commands in Matthew 10 and Matthew 15, but by their disobedience. And afterwards they said, this is not what the Lord intended, but it's happening and it's too late to stop it. Let's put something into the record to make it look like this is what Jesus intended. So, according to the liberals, according to the Muslim strategists, Jesus' disciples invented the Great Commission fraudulently after the fact and edited in to the end of Matthew, the end of Mark, and a few other places. Well, that represents an upward leap in the sophistication of Muslim anti-Christian propaganda. Is it important that Christians everywhere, especially Christian pastors out there confronting Islam in much more than we do, understand how to respond to that newfangled attack on the Great Commission upon the very right of Christianity to exist? What do you think? Thank you, John. How about the rest of you? You think it's important? Well, my son Shannon had heard his papa teach about those two problem passages, and he was ready for the mullah and turned the tables on him. So, let's talk about Matthew chapter 10, verses 5 and 6, where Jesus said, do not go among the Gentiles or enter any village of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. If you look at that passage, just go down a few verses to verse Matthew chapter 5. Look at what Jesus said in verse 18. It's part of the same discourse. He said, I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter nor text would be, pardon me, Matthew chapter 10 and verse 18. I said 5, that's a mistake. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 18 is where Jesus said, on my account you will be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. So what does verse 18 indicate about the restriction of verses 5 and 6? Was it permanent or temporary? It was temporary. He's letting them know at a later time they would be his witnesses to Gentiles, but not yet. Why not yet? Let me ask you, at the stage of the disciples' spiritual development represented by Matthew chapter 10, were they about ready to graduate from Jesus' three-year field training program? Or were they still in the freshman class? Freshmen. Were they spiritually mature? Had they learned to get over their squeamishness about ceremonial defilement from contact with Gentiles? Or were they still subject to extreme squeamishness? So were they culturally, spiritually, mentally ready to be sent out on ministry to Gentiles? Or no way. Consider, long after the period represented by Matthew chapter 10, Peter, who had already been through the day of Pentecost and heard the great commission, had his mind open to understand those two mega themes. How many times did God have to give him the vision of the sheet let down from heaven before he was willing to get over his squeamishness, his reticence, and go into the house of an uncircumcised Gentile man like Cornelius and preach to him and even eat with him and his family? 3 times. Well, it took a pretty strong threefold prompting, prodding from heaven to get Peter to be willing to do that. That was much later. How much less would Peter and the others have been ready to go on a cross-cultural mission at this early stage? And when Peter came back to Jerusalem after his blessed interaction with Cornelius and his household, what did the other apostles say? How wonderful God used you to go in among those Gentiles and bless them. This is the beginning of new things. No, they were virtually threatening to impeach Peter for compromising the ideals. So you see, if it was still that entrenched later after all the further influences, how much less were the disciples ready to be sent out among people they regarded as unclean and just, they just felt all creepy crawly getting too close to a Gentile. Going into a Gentile house, suppose, for example, in this Matthew chapter 10 period, Jesus has said, I want you to go, Peter, James, and John, you go over into Decapolis and preach to the Greeks. Don't look at me that way. I'm the master. You're the disciples. You have to obey. Go. And he sends the others maybe to the Samaritans. Let's follow Peter, James, and John. Let's have a little scenario on how it might have worked out. They wade through the upper Jordan, go over into Decapolis. The Greeks see him coming and say, hello, strangers from Galilee. What brings you over to our side of the lake? We're here because our master sent us to preach to you. Oh, who, by the way, is your master? Jesus of Nazareth. What? Did you say Jesus of Nazareth sent you over here? Oh, if he sent you, you're as welcome as the flowers in May. Wait, I'm in the southern hemisphere. What do you say the flowers in? Not May, but... I mean, which month is your spring? September, the flowers in September. Yes, we up north we say the flowers in May. Some of us have already been over into Galilee and been healed by your master. We think he's great. So he sent you. That's great. Now look, you waded through the river. Your clothes are dipping wet. Sun's gone behind a cloud. Wind's begun to blow. You're going to get your death of cold. We got to get you warm. Look at Jason standing up there in his doorway. He was over into Galilee, been healed by your master. He will welcome you into his home for sure. And look, see the smoke curling from his fireplace, his chimney? Jason got a fire going in his fireplace, and he's got a very large living room. So come into Jason's living room, get toasty warm and dry by his fireplace while we summon all the people in our village to pack in there to hear your preaching. Preach to us under the shelter of Jason's roof. Now, don't you know it's forbidden for us Jews to enter your unclean Gentile households? We'll stand out here in the street and preach, shivering or not. Oh, yes, yes, we knew about that sort of sentiment. We just thought maybe since he sent you, you might not say that, but all right. Let it be out in the street. But you must be hungry. You've walked a long way. May we offer you some food? No, we brought our own kosher food with us, and that'll do just fine. Could they have been a blessing? Absolutely not. Jesus knew they were not ready. He very wisely chose not to inflict them upon Gentiles or Samaritans prematurely. That is the only reason you need to understand the logic of a temporary restriction. The liberals overlook this, and even some conservative theologians overlook it as well, and teach from the Gospel of Matthew in a way that would not present this sort of understanding. Oh, yes, well, so much for that problem passage. Let's go to the next one. It's in Matthew chapter 15. And it's important to notice what is happening in the first 20 verses of Matthew 15 in order to understand what is happening in this very controversial passage that begins in Matthew 15, verse 21. In Matthew chapter 15, the first 20 verses, Jesus was leading his disciples through a field of grain, and his disciples were hungry. They broke off some ears of corn or grain, whatever it was, and began munching without having washed their hands first. You mothers, guess you can maybe understand. Some of the teachers of the law saw that and they criticized Jesus, saying, your disciples are eating with unwashed hands. They're breaking the law. And so they were discrediting Jesus and his ministry because of a violation of one of two categories of law that are found in the Old Testament. The two categories of law are the ritual law, otherwise known as the ceremonial law. Please say ritual ceremonial law. Consisting of things like thou shalt not eat, not boil the meat of the baby goat and the milk that came from the baby goat's mother, and not going into a Gentile household and washing your hands and not mixing certain kinds of food together and so forth. All kinds of requirements of ritual law. And another one was, it's all right to wash dishes on the Sabbath day as long as you use a sponge, not a cloth, because it takes less energy to squeeze the water out of a sponge than it does to wring the water out of a piece of cloth. Things like that, that are still in Judaism today. And so what is the other category of law in the Old Testament? Adjacent to the ritual ceremonial law was the moral ethical law, with commandments like thou shalt not commit murder, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. All right, there are these two categories of law. Which one do you suppose God intended to be the priority, the ritual or the moral? The moral law was supposed to be the high priority. The ritual law was added to the moral law as a set of object lessons illustrating issues of the moral law. But which of these two categories of law did the Jews tend to prioritize over the passage of centuries? They tended to prioritize honoring the ritual law above honoring the moral law. As you read through the Gospels, you'll find Jesus rebuking the rabbis, the Pharisees, and others for exploiting details of the ritual law as a basis for violating aspects of the moral law, saying it is written, thou shalt not do such and such, but you say. You see that again and again. All right, so were Jesus' disciples guilty of honoring the ritual law above the moral law? Yes, they were. What was the main reason they could not freely interact with Gentiles the way they'd seen Jesus doing? their obsession that had been inculcated in them through years of listening to rabbis teach in avoiding contact with Gentiles. They're unclean, and the ritual law has to be honored, and you cannot mingle with Gentiles and be good to them, because in the process you will get some kind of ceremonial defilement, and that is absolutely forbidden. So here the teachers of the law voiced their criticism, and Jesus responded by emphasizing the priority of the moral law above the ritual law, saying, "What goes into a man's mouth does not make him unclean." When he referred to what goes into a man's mouth, he was referring to violations of which of these two categories of law? The ritual. He said, "What comes out of a man's mouth, that is what makes him unclean," referring to violations of the moral law. So he emphasized that very strongly through the first 20 verses of Matthew chapter 15. And were the disciples supposed to get the lesson? Were they supposed to understand? And were they supposed to be able to, as it were, cross a threshold to a new way of thinking about the law? Understanding that you are not to allow squeamishness, reticence based on the ritual law to keep you from fulfilling the moral law, part of which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And did Jesus define a Samaritan as a neighbor? Yes. So it was so necessary that these barriers that Judaism had built up should be broken down in the minds of his disciples, or they could not be Christian apostles. And Jesus was preparing them to be apostles for the establishment of the church. Well, right after he taught them that major lesson, he led them out of Galilee, across the border into Syria, and they didn't even stop there. They kept going through the panhandle of Syria. I guess you don't have the word panhandle here, do you? No. Oklahoma, the state of Oklahoma, has a narrow strip that goes out for 150 miles or so. It's like the handle of a pan. Oklahoma's the pan, here's the handle. And Texas has a panhandle, so we use that phrase panhandle. But anyway, it's just a narrow strip. Okay, narrow strip will do. Or say panhandle. You don't mind being Americanized just a little bit, do you? You don't want to get ceremonially defiled here. So they went through the narrow part of Syria into the second removed Gentile nation called Phoenicia. Did the disciples feel at home up there? Did they feel at ease? Just imagine them tensing up. Here we are getting close to all these Gentiles. Oh, these Phoenicians, they do such awful things, and they eat wrong kinds of food, and they don't wash properly, and ooh, ooh, ooh. Jesus led them up there. I wonder why. Could it be he led them up there for a test? A test to see if they had learned the lesson he just finished teaching them? Well, let's read on and find out. So, beginning in verse 21, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman. A Canaanite woman. Oh, yes, a Canaanite woman. From that vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." She's obviously heard reports about Jesus healing people from Syria. Maybe there'd even been some from Decapolis went down along with the Syrians and were healed coming down from the north into Galilee. And she's thinking, if he can heal all these Syrians, surely he can heal my daughter from that other Gentile nation. So, what do you expect Jesus is going to do? Has he already strongly set a precedent for saying yes to that sort of a request from Gentiles? Gentiles from Syria, Gentiles from Decapolis, a Latin, centurions. So, the precedent has been set. We expect he's going to say yes, yes, and he casts the demon out and it's done. Instead, we read, Jesus did not answer a word. This is the first of six apparent flaws in Jesus' character in this passage. An apparent flaw of insensitivity. Turning a cold shoulder to a mother pleading for the deliverance of her daughter from demonic oppression? How could he be so insensitive? So what's the first apparent flaw? Insensitivity. Say it out loud. And the disciples are shocked, just like you and I are. You feel shocked, don't you, that he would not say yes after having strongly set the precedent for saying yes in situations like that? So what does disciples do? Here's what we read. His disciples came to him and urged him, Lord, have mercy on her. Why are you declining? Is it because you're afraid of ceremonially defiled? Didn't you just finish teaching us that's not a problem? And healing her daughter would be honoring the moral law above the ritual law? Is that what they said? No. What did they say? Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us. All right, so have they learned the lesson? Nope. Still back at square one. They're still reacting negatively to the close proximity of what they regard as an unclean person in the same old way. And so, if she'd been a Jewish woman, would they have said, send her away? No. It's because she's Gentile. And they are afraid she will become a source of ritual defilement for them as a group of Jews. And so, I can just imagine they even felt some pleasure saying, you know, Jesus has been so open to all these Gentiles. He's been spending so much time welcoming Gentiles from Syria and Gentiles from Decapolis and healing them. And reports of this are getting back down to Jerusalem. And the Jewish leaders there are not going to be impressed. They're going to say, how can he be our Messiah when he's showing so much, giving so much help to Gentiles? He should be focused upon the Jews if he's a Messiah. Interpreting the Messiah's job description as actually anti-Pentalogic, being opposed to Gentiles. And so this is going to make it really difficult for the new Messianic corporation to turn a profit in the first year. If only we could encourage them to be discriminating against Gentiles and they would hear some reports about that, maybe there'd be some hope. And suddenly they see Jesus manifesting apparent discrimination against a Gentile woman. And what do they say? This is what we want to see more often, so let's reinforce this, shall we? This is Skinnerian conditioning. You know, you're taking college courses on Skinnerian conditioning? It means, and parents apply it to their children, and children apply it to their parents. When you see the kind of behavior you'd like to see manifested more often, what do? You encourage it with a compliment, with a smile, with a pat on the back, with a handshake, this is great. Oh, that's wonderful. You did the right thing. When you see the kind of behavior you don't want to see manifested more often, what do? Frown, or shake your head, or appear unimpressed. And what is the purpose of responding one way or the other? To try to reinforce a more desirable kind of behavior. I heard of a college professor teaching a class on Skinnerian conditioning, and unknown to him, the members of the class got together after the first session and decided they would apply the techniques on him while he was teaching them about the techniques. So they all agreed, if he stands to the right of the lectern, we'll just start browsing in paperback novels, snoozing, looking bored, looking out the window, writing notes and passing them, sighing, yawning. If he happens to step over to this side of the lectern, we'll suddenly lay down the paperback novel and find his comments interesting. We'll be taking notes. And we'll be telling other people, listen to him. Within just a matter of hours, they had him teachingly continuously from this side of the lectern. He was not the slightest aware that they had conditioned him to. So he found out what they'd done. He gave them all an A for that part of the course. So you professors here at this Bible college, beware now. Don't let yourself be conditioned. So here the disciple, look at that. He's not saying yes. Oh, come on, everybody, let's all jump in with both feet and encourage them. So, yes, Lord, yes, yes, send her away. She keeps crying out. They don't realize what's afoot here. they're being tested. All right, so when they urged him to send her away, that is when he said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Not first, but only. That's the second apparent flaw here of inconsistency. Do you see why I suggest that? Has he already been healing lots of Gentiles? From Matthew chapter 4 onward, healing Gentiles from Syria, Gentiles from Decapolis, wide open, free ministry of healing and teaching for lots of Gentile people. And suddenly, here he is saying, I have no theological basis to minister that way. That's a problem of inconsistency, right? So how many apparent flaws do we have now? What was the first one? Insensitivity compounded by inconsistency, violating his own strongly established precedent. Well, let's read on. So, he answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Verse 25, the woman took mortal offense, went off in a huff and said, that does it, I'll never, never, never approach a Jew for anything ever again. Aren't you glad she didn't respond that way? She didn't, because something encouraged her. What could that have been? Let's keep that thought in mind. Instead of going away, disappointed, disillusioned, sad, she came and knelt before him and said, Lord, help me. She's pressing her request a second time. He replied, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. He's calling her a dog because of her racial origin. That's an ethnic insult coming from the lips of our Lord. So now we have a third apparent flaw, and that is rudeness. So let's say how many are there now. First, insensitivity aggravated by inconsistency, compounded further by rudeness. Calling a woman a dog. It gets worse. When Jesus made that statement, he was employing three figures of speech. And what were those three figures of speech? The first one was children, dogs, and the children's bread. Okay, who did he mean by children? The children of, give me an A, an I, and a J. Children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Jewish people. In other words, the children of the covenant are the children, right? Who did he mean by dogs? Gentiles. Now there is that third figure of speech, children's bread. If the children are the children of the covenant, what would be the children's bread? The what of the covenant? The blessing. Which part of the covenant blessing was for the children? The top line blessing. So, Jesus is endorsing the top line blessing for the children of the covenant and denying any other kind of blessing for Gentiles. So is that a biblical statement or an unbiblical one? Unbiblical. He's truncating the covenant, saying it only has blessing for the children. It does not have blessing for people outside the Gentiles. That is a truncation of the Abrahamic covenant, flat and simple. So we have a fourth apparent flaw of unbiblicalness. What sort of a pit is our Lord digging himself into here? Can we rescue him from it? Insensitivity, inconsistency, rudeness compounded with unbiblicalness, denying a part of the covenant, the latter part of the covenant. But wait. How many parts of the covenant were sealed with the divine oath? Just the top line or the top and bottom line? The oath covered both. Remember yesterday? The oath covered both the top line of the covenant and the bottom line. For those of you who weren't here, yes, top line is the part of the covenant where God's promising to bless Abraham and his descendants. The bottom line is the part where he's promising to bless all peoples on earth through them. So here he is endorsing the top line, negating the bottom line, chopping the covenant short. Unbiblical, because both parts of the covenant were sealed with a divine oath, if he meant that statement to be taken literally at face value, Jesus was undoing the oath for the second part of the covenant. And if you are under oath and break your word, it's worse than lying. What is it called? Perjury. So this is the fifth apparent flaw, perjury. This is getting grim, isn't it? Ooh. There's still one more flaw to hear about if you can bear it. Oh. When he said that, the Canaanite woman said, "Yes, Lord, but even Gentile dogs like me get to eat some crumbs that fall from the master's table." And that is when Jesus said, "Woman, great is your faith, your request is granted." And that's the sixth apparent flaw, fickleness. How could Jesus be saying no, 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 five times, and then say yes? Fickleness. What are we going to do with this passage? Well, if you read what some learned commentators say about it in their commentaries on the Gospel of Matthew, you'll find some are what I call hardline interpreters. They say Jesus literally meant to exclude her from the blessing of a miracle because of her Gentile origin. And when they say that, which other verses in Matthew are they ignoring? The ones in Matthew chapter 4. It's like they don't know Matthew chapter 4 is saying he was healing Syrians from all over Syria and Greeks from Decapolis. And that centurion, that Roman centurion's probably Latin servant. Overlooking that, as if that was a consistent policy. There was no inconsistency when he said that. Oh, how can they possibly say that? But these hardline interpreters say, yes, he wanted to exclude her from the blessing of a miracle because she was Gentile, but she somehow managed to wear down his resistance by her sheer doggedness. She was, after all, a Canaanite woman. Okay, you don't get it. Never mind. Someone said, Other interpreters are not so hardline. They say, of course, he intended all along to work a miracle for the woman's daughter. He just wanted to test the woman's faith a little first. To which I respond with due respect, saying, baloney. If there was something there that was being tested, was it the woman's faith or the disciples? It was the disciples that were being tested. This gets overlooked so. Oh, how can it be so overlooked? Look at the context. That's what he was teaching. Leading right up to that passage, the disciples were the ones who were being tested, and Jesus was exploiting the woman as his accomplice to test them. Meanwhile, how did he manage to keep the woman from being totally offended and rebuffed by his seeming resistance to grant her request? Have you ever heard two men talking to each other, and it sounds like they're insulting each other? And you listen to the words they're saying, if these two guys hate each other, this is awful. Maybe they'll come to blows. How can I be a peacemaker here? But then you look closer and you see they both have a twinkle in their eyes. And you heave a sigh, oh, these guys are friends. They can talk to each other like that because they really like each other and they understand each other. It's not an offense at all. It is an expression of friendship in a strange sort of way. In a situation like that, which is more important, the words they're actually speaking or the twinkle in their eyes? The twinkle outweighs the words in significance. In other words, body language can convey more meaning than the words that are actually spoken. Right. So it's quite evident that Jesus was employing some form of body language, keeping it unnoticed by the disciples, but making sure the woman saw it, so that she would be encouraged while he was staging a test for them. And so we don't know what body language was like in Jewish culture 2,000 years ago, but for the sake of simplicity, let's assume it was a twinkle in Jesus' eye, okay? Now, You don't need to come up to me after I finish teaching about this and say, Don, the Greek makes no mention of a twinkle there. I know that already. But I know something else. Ancient narrative literature used very few verbs to describe body language the way we do today. You don't find a lot of expressions about body language. It's so rare in the Greek New Testament. wherever it says someone prostrated himself on the ground in prayer, that's body language, or bowing is body language. But it's so rare. I mean, think of in Acts chapter 7, when Stephen was preaching that politically unpopular sermon, they gnashed their teeth at him. I wonder what that sounded like or looked like. Whatever. That's an expression of body language. And there's another one in Acts chapter 14, where Paul and Barnabas rushed out into the crowd among the Lycaonians who were getting ready to offer a pagan sacrifice to them, as thinking they were Zeus and Hermes. And they tore their clothes. Jewish body language for getting attention for an important protest. Tearing your clothes, that's body language. And it says Jesus wept. But it never says he smiled or shrugged. So in modern narrative literature, we have such an abundance of verbs to communicate body language, like nodding, shaking your head, waving, looking at your watch, you know, wincing, grimacing. They didn't use a lot of verbs like that 2,000 years ago. But did we moderns invent body language, or has it always been there? Scholars estimate 70% of what we humans communicate among ourselves is communicated not via words but via body language. So it must have been there. And let's assume it was a twinkle in the eye. And the fact that the Greek doesn't mention it is just an evidence it wasn't the literary style to do that sort of thing. All right. If the Greek did make mention of the twinkle, how might this passage have translated? Let's read it again. Jesus did not answer a word, twinkle, twinkle. His disciples, not noticing the twinkle, came to him and urged him, "Send her away, she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel," twinkle, twinkle. The woman, detecting the twinkle, feels encouraged. She's saying to herself, "Somehow I sense he's really not rejecting me. All those other reports that I've heard about him healing people like me, I think I'm not misinformed, so I'm not going to give up. I'm going to ask again. I have to be sure before I go away." So she's sufficiently encouraged by something to repeat her request. That's when Jesus said, "It is not right to take the children's bread and share it with a Gentile dog like you," twinkle, twinkle. By this time, the disciples noticed the twinkle. And I can imagine Peter elbowing James on one side and John elbowing, that's another body language word, saying, "Did you hear what he just said? Do you recognize that that was a satirical revision of the Abrahamic covenant?" He's letting us know that's how our interpretation of it sounds to him. Sounds kind of awful, actually, when you say it that way. And that means he's going to heal our daughter just when we thought he was turning a corner, learning to be a more discriminating Messiah. Here we are back to square one. There he's done it. He's healed her daughter. They're so embarrassed. They realize they were set up. They were tested, and they failed the test. The lesson he just taught them went in one ear and out the other. Meanwhile, the woman, thoroughly encouraged by the brightening twinkle, is saying to the Lord, "Yes, Lord, but even Gentile dogs like me get to eat some crumbs that fall from the master's table," twinkle, twinkle. And Jesus glows and says, "Woman, great is your faith. Your request is granted. Bless your heart, dear. You played your part beautifully just now." Thank God more and more interpreters of this passage in more recent commentaries on Matthew are finally turning a corner and beginning to acknowledge this is the real dynamic. Some of them don't go quite far enough. They say this is an example of humor in Jesus' ministry. Well, thank you for that. It's more than humor. It's a master teacher employing satire as a powerful teaching tool.